Welcome to the Company Forensics Podcast. It's an extension of our very popular YouTube series. In this podcast, we hear forensic stories from the founders themselves, and our guest today is a very special one. We like to think our YouTube channel has been the first glimpse into the startup world for many of our viewers, and the first experience with this world of tech startups and fast growth, and we like to think of ourselves as that first introduction. But that aha moment happened for me about 8 years ago, and the man responsible is Steve Barsh, who is our guest today. Back then, Dream Adventures was an accelerator, and my company had just gotten accepted. And I remember Steve's talk distinctively, and it was truly the beginning of this journey for me. So a few years later, Steve and I reconnected over our YouTube channels, and you've probably seen him as our guest in other videos. Dream It is no longer an accelerator, and that is what we're going to talk about today, how this venture capital firm had to reinvent itself and why. Before Dream It, Steve was an entrepreneur himself. He started a company called Packlade, which we'll talk about in a sec. It became the largest real-time global vacation rental network way before Airbnb, and he then became an angel investor himself. He also happens to be a licensed pilot, which I absolutely envy and I will not talk about anymore. And then Steve also joined our expert network recently, so you will be able to book office hours with Steve starting today. That's all for the intro. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
What we really want to talk about is this Dream It story, of which I really don't know anything about.
So thanks for having me. Great to be here. I got the entrepreneurial bug when I was really young. I started doing software development before I went to college, got a computer science degree and started my first company in my senior year of college. I started that company and bootstrapped it, and 7 years later sold it to a communications company called MCI. After that, I went on, and I've done multiple other ventures, multiple other startups, sometimes successful, sometimes not. One of the more recent startups I did was Packlade, which we did back in around 09 or so, and it was really interesting for 2 or 3 years. We built it up, grew it to a certain point, and actually decided to shut it down after a while. Airbnb was starting to pass us on what they were doing, and what we were doing was interesting, but not that interesting. And when you're in the venture world, you want to go big or go home. And it was really not going to go big. So we decided to shut it down. And that was actually with the encouragement of our venture investors who said, Steve, you know what? We think you're starting to waste your time at this point. Shut it down. We're big boys. You know, we're used to investing and we just don't think this is a worthwhile effort. And we're ready to take a loss and time to move on. So it was really interesting. By the way, it's when you realize when venture investors are really great when they help you in a difficult situation like that and help you through that situation.
I want to just stop on that because you mentioned the line from the investors, which was, we're big boys, we're willing to take a loss. I'm assuming you guys were doing great, you guys were generating revenue, you could have become profitable, you could have continued with the company. Does that relate to the bet that venture investors make, venture capital investors? Is it that big for them to be successful and otherwise it just doesn't make sense for them?
Yeah, you know, we were doing top line, $1.3 million in revenue in top line and capturing about a 15% margin, which is nothing to write home about. But we were doing over $1 million a year in revenue. But the company was going to take a lot more capital, and you could see the trajectory, and I could see it too. We had pivoted the company 3 or 4 times over a 3-year period. We only went through only about $1.5 million over those 3 or so years. And you could just see, like, we hadn't discovered anything really big yet. And having already brought in over $1 million in outside capital and knowing we were going to need a lot more, and we really hadn't discovered anything breakthrough yet, it was starting at that point to be like a waste of time. You know, why put another 2 or 3 million behind that when there's no clear path to build something really, really big? And in the venture world, again, it's kind of go big or go home. They're swinging for the fences and they're expecting you as a CEO. It's almost like you're an astronaut getting strapped into a rocket ship and you want to go to the moon or die trying. And Packlade at the time when we looked at it, it's like, this is not going to go to the moon. So like, let's end it here. Let's not put more good money after bad or more bad money after good as it may be, and decided mutually to shut it down. But what was really interesting as an entrepreneur, that's a very difficult decision to make.
How do you move from entrepreneur to investor?
So I had done kind of both. So I was at Dream It Ventures very early on in 09. I was at Dream It when SeatGeek started from scratch and NodeHall started and all these companies started very early on. And I was there and helped run Dream It for about a year or two and then decided I wanted to do one more startup, which was Packlade. So maybe that wasn't the best decision. And then I went back to Dream It later. Dream It to me is just a very specialized type of startup. People say, well, you used to be an operator, now you're a venture investor. I still consider myself an operator. Dream It as a company is, in a sense, it's almost like a startup that helps other startups.
How did Dream It as an accelerator got started
it's three founders, right? Three successfully exited entrepreneurs that wanted to start an accelerator to give back and help other entrepreneurs. So it was started with one of those very early accelerator models, and it really evolved over time. And in the beginning, it was kind of an interesting way for them to give back and help other entrepreneurs that didn't have something like a Dream It that helped them see around corners and figure out, you know, is that an oncoming train or is it the light at the end of the tunnel, to really navigate the challenges of building a startup. And it was a very interesting time. But over the years, Dream It has really evolved. We consider ourselves a venture fund that almost has like a pre-investment program, that has a program that takes companies through a process of gaining customer traction, gaining investment traction, and then making an investment in the companies after they've spent about 6 or 8 months, after we've added a lot of strong material value. We make the investment after the fact, not beforehand.
Let's talk about that accelerator model, because I was one of those companies, the traditional accelerator, and it was an amazing soft landing into how startups work. That's why I believe that this idea of bringing all the founders together into the same office, creating this sort of community, is this accelerator crash course of 3 months. But obviously, if you guys moved away from that, and I believe that at that time, this is 2012 when I did Dream It, you could find a list of hundreds of accelerators who are trying to do that same thing, and you see less of that now. I perceive that model as game-changing for my journey as an entrepreneur.
Sure.
But from the accelerator side, it doesn't seem to have worked that well for many of them. So what happened?
Again, at the end of the day, we now consider ourselves a venture investor. How do we find the best startups from around the world? How do we work with them? How do we invest in them? So part of that in the journey like that you went through with us in 2012 and what's evolved, part of it is a lot of our thinking has evolved as to what stage of startup do we want to really work with. Like, we really enjoy working with startups that already have product now and are at early traction or early revenue. Like, most startups that come into Dream It today are 2 to 3 years old. Most have probably raised around $250,000 already. And they have product, they have either early revenue or early traction. So what's interesting to us, in a sense, the startups are slightly de-risked. And part of that is the model and the journey. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. The journey that we take them through when they go through Dream It today. We still work hard on community. It's still very crash coursey, as in Dream It is extremely intense. When you talk to entrepreneurs and startups that have been through Dream It, they'll talk about the material impact that we have on their company's founders that are on their second or third startup when they go through Dream It and they think, oh my God, I wish I had taken my earlier startups through. This is such a better process. The way our thinking has evolved is we like working with a little later stage company. If we offer them today 6%, we'll take 6% of your company for $25,000, or let's ramp that forward to what some accelerators are doing today. Hey, for $120,000, we get 6% of your company. That's around a $2 million valuation. Most Dream It startups that come in today, that was their valuation from 2 years prior. It would almost be a down round for them to come into Dream It. So instead of saying, well, you know, we'll give you an upfront check for $100,000, but we want 6% of your company, which is like a 2.2, I'd have to do the math, $2.2 million valuation. We say we're going to do a completely different offer and a different structure, but it's because we're talking to a different type of company. And sometimes a founder will say to us, hey, wait, could you give us $100,000? Sure. And it's almost like an IQ test. If they'd sell 6% of their company for $100,000, that's a bad sign if they're willing to make that decision, because that's a really crappy valuation. It really is.
There are few accelerators who are still operating on that model, the smaller check, the smaller valuation. Should entrepreneurs still go for those accelerators?
I think if, you know, maybe there's an accelerator out there that's really tuned for what they're doing. Maybe they're doing something that's in fintech or insurtech, and there's an accelerator that has a deep edge in that. Maybe there's some other value you're going to get out of that accelerator, possibly. I don't know. And I have to tell you, I have a very strong bias here. I think less than 5% of quote unquote accelerators around the world have had any substantial material value to a startup. I've guest lectured, so to say. I've gone into lots of accelerators around the world, met lots of startups. And you just look at what that accelerator is doing, and they're not accelerating anything. I don't see that they're adding real substantial material value to those startups. They're not helping them de-risk. I've gone to multiple demo days, and I'll watch 15 startups get up on a stage and, you know, do startup theater. And I watch them, and I just sit there and think, these companies, a lot of times, aren't very good. And what have they been doing for the last 3 months? I just watch them pitch, and just all I hear is assumptions and things not de-risked and things that make absolutely no sense that would never happen to a company that spends time with Dream It.
there was this notion that out of the 15 companies that you used to accept in that in the old mode, right, in the 25K check, you guys were betting on one or two successes out of this 15 company batch. You were sort of prepared for many of these companies to not raise money and therefore go bust.
Yep.
It seems that this new bet for you guys is, you know, we'll take in 15 companies and we'll make 15 companies succeed because they were ready. They were de-risked. Is that more or less the idea?
Our success rate is going way up. Yeah. Yeah. Because when you're at that stage, when you're at that super early stage and it's ideas on the back of a napkin and you're writing upfront checks, your success rate is going to be much lower because you really don't know much about the company. So they're coming in. Look, there's still a lot of risk involved. There's risk all over the place, but it's certainly a little less risk. And we want every company that goes through Dream It today, we look at them when they're starting at Dream It because we don't write an upfront check anymore. We have to go into that situation and bring a company into Dream It. And we literally will say out loud in meetings to each other, is this a company that we feel 6 to 9 months from now, there's a very high likelihood we're going to write a check based on what we know today. Now, we're going to know a lot more. We'll add a lot more value. But if we don't have that conviction up front, they shouldn't be coming in to Dream It.
When these companies come in, they've already raised some money. And they've raised some money on front end.
Usually. Some have bootstrapped, which is fine. But yeah, usually.
What are the usual terms for that company, for that pre-accelerator company? You're not on accelerator anymore. Pre-program company.
Yeah.
On what terms did those companies raise money at that super early stage?
They will have raised $250,000 to as much as $1 million. A lot of times it'll be a cap note. You know, it was a $6 million cap or an $8 million cap on a note that they raised, something along those lines. It might be a little bit lower than that. So they come in at varying stages. Our check size is $500,000. What does that look like? So when companies come in, we get a small amount of upfront, almost like advisor equity. It's a really small amount to go through the heavy lift of Dream It. And then we get $500,000 investment right in their most recent round. If they just closed a round within the last month or two getting into Dream It, sometimes it's going to be that round. Most of the time, it's the next round coming up and we get an investment right. That valuation, when we're writing the check for $500,000, is their fair market valuation. It's their FMV. It's not $500,000 for 6% or 10%. It floats with the market. We're just writing a check with whatever that round was. The process of Dream It is a very heavy lift for us. So there needs to be something in there. Otherwise, we'd just be a regular VC firm and we'd write $500,000 checks, but we want to add more value than that.
You talked about killing Demo Day and about startup theater.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
We could do a really great job of taking almost any startup and putting them up on stage and them give a 3 or 4 minute pitch. And you have no idea what's really going on. If Demo Day goes really well and there's some investors in the audience, the best possible outcome is you go meet with investors. And we really found what that was all about was how good could the startup look like? How great was their pitch? You're being judged on your ability to pitch. And what's much more important is how great is the startup? It's not just putting somebody up on stage and making them look great. So what we decided to do is let's skip the startup theater stage and go right to the investors. So now what we call them is investor sprints. We also find that most investors are getting very tired of going to demo days and seeing dozens or hundreds like one after the other. So we'll send to investors that we know, which is a couple thousand. We'll send them a list of here's 10, 15, 6 startups that have just completed Dream It and are about to raise. Who do you want to meet with? You're being more efficient for the startup's time and you're being more efficient on the investor's time. We actually do something right before investor sprints called mock VC meetings where we come back in and like, it's one of my favorite things to do. I'd come back in and like, Kaya, it's nice to meet you. I'm Steve. Right. We've known each other for like 5 months. Right. But now I don't know you anymore. So tell me the story. And we take them through this mock VC process and we are the worst hell of a VC you've ever met in your life for the questions we ask. And it's great because a lot of Dream It startups will be like, take it up to level 11. I mean, completely take the gloves off. Get me ready. Because a startup that comes out of Dream It that goes and meets with investors, they've been so pressure tested in every aspect of the whole business model and everything they're doing has been so beaten up. We tell startups, when you're done Dream It, you actually shouldn't need your deck anymore because you so understand the story and you're so ready for that process. And then just to end that, one great thing that we hear from investors meet with Dream It startups is they'll say to us, you know, I met with 5 Dream It startups this afternoon. I don't know what you do with these companies, but oh my God, they are just so tight. Like everywhere you take them, everywhere you go, they either have a good answer or know how to come back with an answer later, which is really great because it's all about having a great story.
Well, so moving to another topic on how the program changed. I know that you guys refocused into a few key industries.
Yeah.
And one of the variables there is that industries like urban tech and healthcare or health tech are industries where the sale is potentially a tough sale. Like my sale of Slidebean is get in front of a bunch of people, thousands or millions of people, and you'll move them down the funnel and convert them. But for many of your companies, for urban tech, for example, it's not like that. It's finding the right person, the right decision maker.
Right.
So how has that specialization changed the landscape for these companies?
The way we look at it is there's a couple of core verticals, and you've been mentioning them, you know, that we want to make bets on, like secure tech, which is largely cybersecurity, for example, or health tech, which is digital health and medical devices. So to us, like you're talking about, sometimes these sales cycles can be very long. We pick those verticals because we think we have a thesis around the verticals. There's a lot of interesting things going on in healthcare and health tech. There's a lot of interesting challenges in cybersecurity. It's a global problem. It's a massive problem and it's growing. So the people that run those verticals have well over a decade of experience of building in those industries and have great Rolodexes and know the ins and outs. They know how to sell in those industries. So we can really push those types of companies along at a very high velocity, because when we have a company going through that Dream It startup process, it's all about accelerating velocity for customer acquisition, market traction, and investor acquisition. So that's why we concentrate on the verticals instead of just being generalist, because we like the verticals, we like the thesis within the verticals, and we know that we can help those types of companies in a really demonstrable way.
I've always insisted that an accelerator could be a bridge, could be a first step, a soft landing, if you will, into the startup world, especially if you're coming from abroad. How does that change?
Not every company needs to be venture-backed. Not every company should be venture-backed, and it's not the only way. Right. If you start doing the accelerator route or like the Dream It route, that means you're going the venture route. And that's not always the right way for every company. If you can bootstrap, bootstrap. That would be my advice. If you can do it on your own, do it on your own. I think the advantage of something like Dream It or other types of other accelerator programs is the deep expertise. If you go with someone, again, that knows what they're doing, I think 95% of people don't add any strong value. You know, when I walk into a quote unquote accelerator and, you know, there's somebody that's got their MBA and is 2 years out of school and they're running the accelerator, they don't actually know much of anything, right? They're going to help this startup figure out their go-to-market strategy. I don't think so at all. But anyway, I think it can make a difference for the right type of company based on what that accelerator or program can do. At Dream It, even before the pandemic, we were running hybrid acceleration. So one of the big changes at Dream It that we made about 4 years ago, we were working and trying to get a startup in the health program, and it was an Israeli startup based outside Tel Aviv in Haifa. I think they're in Haifa. And we said to them, it's great. You're an awesome health tech company. We want you to be part of Dream It. The founder was in his early 40s. His team was up and running. They were doing things. And we said, so here's what you need to do. You need to come to Philadelphia, because this is where we're running the cohort, for the next 3 months. He's like, well, that's easy. I've got three kids under the age of 12. The answer is no, I'm out. We're like, wait a second. We're going to lose a great company because of this restriction that we're going to put on them. You have to physically move. And we're like, wait, we're losing great companies because we're forcing them to move. Look, if you want to move, that's one thing. But there's no reason to force a company because, again, when you look at Dream It and the stage that we're working at, I'd say the average age of a Dream It entrepreneur is probably in their late 20s to early 30s. We have entrepreneurs that have gone through Dream It in their late 40s and people that are still in their teens. But these companies are up and running. The entrepreneurs tend to be a little bit older, right? They might have one or two kids. So we don't force them to relocate. So we would run this hybrid program. Right now, it's completely hybrid. But what we would do, even when it's non-pandemic, they'd come to Dream It for kickoff and spend a week together, get to meet us, meet the other companies, and then go back to where they're from. And we'd work with them digitally. Then we get back together for 2 weeks of customer sprints. Then they go home and they get back together for 2 weeks of investor sprints. So we did this hybrid, so it really optimized their time, but we didn't force them to move because it was so artificial. It was actually a negative. Oh, by the way, if you force someone to move to Silicon Valley, so they can work from a hacker house and once a week get together for a dinner. What's that all about, right? We do dinners and we get people together when we're together for a purpose. Otherwise, it's hybrid location.
That's interesting. And I think it relates very much to the stage of the company, right? There's a certain stage in which, and a certain industry of a company as well, where moving is really a pain in the ass and it may be more expensive than the alternative, for sure.
Correct.
You touched on a few things on the location of the companies and the stage and the age of entrepreneurs. I want to go back to that. Is late 20s, early 30s an ideal age for a number of reasons as to start a company or the type of entrepreneur or founder that you guys aim for?
We don't aim for an age, a race, a religion, a nothing. It's just what comes at us. Right. And I think what tends to happen, again, we had an entrepreneur start dreaming a few years ago and she couldn't go out to the bar with us because she wasn't 21. Right. So it's kind of funny. It was like, we're about to serve alcohol. Like, wait, how old are you? I'm just turning 20. Like, oh God, we can't serve you alcohol. So we work with younger entrepreneurs. I think when you look at some really interesting studies, some of the most successful startups have been founded by people in like their mid to late 30s. And the reason why, it's when people have been working and toiling away in an industry really down deep and seen a problem that's really bothering them. So that classic, like you start it in your dorm room and you move out of there and you build a company. I mean, I did that, right? I literally started a company. I was still at University of Michigan. It was my senior year. That does happen. But you see that a lot of successful companies are people a little bit later in their career because they experienced something and they just said, I can't take it anymore. Which tends to be people a little bit more in their later 20s or early 30s after they've got 5 or 10 years of deep domain experience and they really find a pain point that they want to go after.
Yeah, I want to echo that a lot because that I think is the ideal motivation for a company is, mm-hmm. you know, I'm in this industry, I found this problem slash business opportunity, and I think that I can solve it better. Sometimes when you're younger, and I've been through this, I started my first company at 21.
Yeah.
You haven't been in an industry, you don't understand that industry. You think you can build something that can make money, but, and maybe you can,
right.
but not necessarily, right? You don't have that expertise. So that's a great point.
Particularly for the health tech companies that we have, when you talk to the founders, why did you start your company? It's usually something very personal. My mom, my aunt, my dad, my brother died from, was diagnosed with, had this issue. I looked for an answer to the problem. I couldn't find it. And I thought, I've got to do something about this. I'd bet at least 50% of the companies start that way. It's something very personal, which is great because as you know, when you talk with founders, you're looking for that deep passion that's within them that is going to carry them through the ups and downs. This is how they deal with the problem. It's really interesting.
Another point I wanted to touch on the whole distance and the whole remote yeah. versus hybrid program is there's the phenomenon of what's been created in California and Silicon Valley is quite amazing, where you have all these companies, all these people, experts in tech that you know move from company to company and sort of bring that knowledge, right? So there's widespread knowledge way beyond you know other startup communities, investors, and so on. So there's that community and people long for or aspire to moving to you know, probably top on the list of Silicon Valley, maybe New York and Austin are coming up next. But you guys go with this approach of, you know, don't move to this location. You don't have to be here. You can get away with not being here.
Sure, absolutely.
And I'm asking for the audience that is not based in California or New York or Austin or Philadelphia,
like right.
how can these guys access or start untapping or start exploring those networks that are physically in places where they're not?
First of all, can I tell you the vast majority of companies that come to Dream It are from New York, Austin, Silicon Valley, and the Pacific Northwest, like Seattle. So all those cities you're mentioning, that's where so many companies are like, I want to go through Dream It because I need to go faster. I'd say 50% of the companies that we have come from those areas that you're talking about. Yeah. So that's one thing. I think for companies, there's a couple things I get kind of passionate about for companies that aren't in those core areas. First of all, the grass isn't always greener on the other side. Certainly living and building a company in Silicon Valley, there are challenges to that. You know, I find a lot of engineers that are in those companies are always jumping to the next hot, shiny thing. And where are my better stock options? And it can be a very ephemeral relationship. It's a very expensive relationship, right? Your cost of living is very high. Your cost of talent is extremely high. Your quality of living, you know, everybody I know during the pandemic, they're like, oh my God, I'm working from home. I'm saving an hour and a half from commuting every single day. So those areas do come with a penalty. But one of the things I want to talk about that we see a lot of startups lament, I guess might be a really good word, is the lack of capital. So I'm in some region of Florida. I'm in Illinois. I'm outside Chicago. I'm not in one of those primary tech hubs. How can I possibly raise capital? Let's just dive into that for a minute. One of the things I say to startups is I call bullshit on them, right? If you've got such a great startup, you've got such a great idea, don't tell me that there's no local capital and that's why you can't get it funded. Because if you're in Minot, North Dakota, and you probably don't know where that is, and I barely know where Minot, North Dakota is, but if you had the cure for cancer and you were a startup based in Minot, North Dakota, and you had the cure for cancer, and by the way, no offense to those people that are from Minot, right? Do you think that company would get funded? 100%. It's the cure for cancer. So don't blame it that your local ecosystem doesn't have the capital to fund your company. Get on an airplane, whether you want to do it during a pandemic or not, set up a Zoom video meeting, get on a JetBlue. And one of the things I've said to startups, look, if you stop your Starbucks habit for about a month, right, for 4 hours a day for a month, it's $120. Fly from Miami to Boston, right? It'll cost you $120. Stay in an Airbnb for a couple bucks and go pitch 5 VCs in Boston. And if you've got a great thing, you will get funded. But when you find that you're having trouble getting the meeting and booking the meeting and you can't get funded, maybe the problem isn't the local capital. Don't blame it on, well, there's no local money. That's why I can't be successful as a startup. I call foul on that. Then go travel, get in your car and drive in your Prius and go pitch investors in a bigger city.
Just to add a comment to that, we did exactly that. We started the company in Costa Rica, made it cheaper, lived here until we had something we could launch and use. And then we moved to New York and aimed at operating the company from there. And we keep both offices.
One of the things we look at Dream It, by the way, is entrepreneurs and startups that are clever on more than one axis. Like, oh, I've got a great product. And we'll be like, and what else? Because we find a lot of times for startups to be successful, you have to be clever in more than one way. You're being clever in more than one way, right? You're running an arbitrage between Costa Rica and New York City. You're arbitraging talent and location and rent and all kinds of things. Anyway, there's lots of ways to hack. And it's great when you see a clever startup that can think about that. And by the way, when we have a company that, you know, we start talking to from Dream It, we look at that. Like, are they clever in more than one way? What's the product? Is it the way they're marketing? What's the unique aspect? You know, everybody else zigged and they're zagging. Like, that's one of the things I love to find. Just as a side note, what's that unique insight? Everybody else is going left and you decided to go right. Why?
Steve, it's a pleasure as always. Thanks for talking today.